In one of the Federalist Papers, it is written, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. Well, human beings being what we are, it's no surprise we've got as much government as we do. I'm Susan McGinnis for Conversations. Today, my guest is a man who keeps track of that antidote to human wickedness, or at least part of it. Today, we'll be talking with U.S. Senate historian Donald Ritchie. Don Ritchie, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
I want to talk about your house, first of all. Talk about the Senate. When the founding fathers, the framers of the Constitution, began to develop the idea of a Senate, did they have any idea? Were they envisioning this powerful and busy outfit we've got in Washington today?
Well, you know, the U.S. Senate is the most powerful upper body of any legislative body, national body in the world. Most of the other parliaments, the British Parliament, for instance, the House of Lords is not equal to the House of Commons. And that's true in every other form of parliamentary government. And the U.S. Senate has remained the equal of the House of Representatives. And that, I think, was intended from the beginning, although perhaps the founders might have been surprised. For instance, James Madison, who really was the principal author of the Constitution, when he himself ran for Congress, he ran for the House of Representatives. And he believed that that would be the chief focus of the people's attention, and that the House would take the lead in passing legislation, and the Senate would perfect the legislation through amending all the bills that came up. Nowadays, the House and the Senate equally take the lead. Sometimes bills originate in the Senate and then go to the House. Sometimes they originate in the House and then go to the Senate. But the idea of the Senate is really critical for the whole concept of our form of government, because the small states right away said, wait, we can't let the big states, we can't let the New Yorks and the Pennsylvanias dominate. And it was the Delawares and the Marylands and the Rhode Islands who said that we have to have a body where all the states are equal. And so in the Senate, regardless of the size or the population of the state, you have two senators. And Alaska and California are equally represented in the Senate, whereas there is one Alaskan representative and there are 52 California representatives. And that's repeated in many other states, keeping a balance so that the minority voice is heard as well as the majority voice. And the Senate has retained that since 1789. That basic principle is what makes the institution work.
In some ways, when we think of the Senate, we think of as the more prestigious, the more powerful unit of the two. Does that have something to do with the few being the mm-hmm. more elite?
I think so. There are only 100 senators, and we're the 435 members of the House. The Senate was the secondary body for the first 50 years, until about the 1830s, when the really dynamic politicians like Henry Clay and Daniel Webster and John C. Calhoun, who'd all served in the House, Clay had been the Speaker of the House for many years, they began to realize that they could use the Senate as the forum for their debates. In those days, senators were elected by the state legislatures, and someone like Clay so dominated the legislature that any time he wanted to go to the Senate, he could go. And he, in fact, came and left many times during his career, and the same thing with Calhoun and with Webster. And since then, the Senate has become the place where the ambitious politicians looking for a career, looking for a step up to running for president or going back to run for governor or whatever, the Senate was always seen as the major forum. And we know famous senators. There are a few members of the House who have national reputations, but it's much harder in that body because you really have to wait your time to get the seniority, to be chairman of a committee or chairman of a major subcommittee. In the Senate, the first day that a brand new senator walks in, that senator, he or she, has an enormous amount of power because the Senate does most of its work by unanimous consent. And it only takes one person to object to a unanimous consent agreement. And freshman senators will stop the works and force attention on an issue that they're interested in a way that a freshman member of the House or even a middle-level member of the House doesn't have that kind of influence.
Mm-hmm. We're talking today with Donald Ritchie, who is an assistant, the assistant Senate historian for this United States. He's been in the Senate Historical Office since 1976. He has a number of books to his credit. He serves actively in historical associations and associations of oral history. We'll be talking about both as we move along in this program. This is Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. I want to ask you about that that I guess the personalities that have guided and framed the U.S. Senate, it doesn't have many guidelines Mm-mm. written down anywhere. Are the personalities the framers of the Senate, or has it been as much the events and circumstances that have moved this nation that have also moved the Senate?
Well, it's been a combination of the two, but definitely the personalities are an important factor. For instance, take the role of majority leader, which is a 20th century phenomenon. Before the 20th century, there was no floor leader of either party. But since the time of Woodrow Wilson, the parties have begun to elect majority leaders. And the majority leader has almost no extra powers over any other senator. About the only power that the majority leader has is the right of first recognition. That means that when all the senators jump up and seek the recognition of the chair will point to the majority leader first and the minority leader. And that's influential and important, but it's very small, actually, in terms of overall power. The majority leader also gets to name members to of his own party to committees, and that can be useful and powerful. But other than that, it's the power of persuasion, as Lyndon Johnson used to say. And you can have a very effective, very powerful majority leader, and you can have a very ineffective leader. It's depended very largely on the individuals who have held the job and how well they worked with their own party, with the other party, the kind of trust that they built up. In a legislative body, your word is very important. If you go back on your word, if you promise to vote one way and then change your vote, you can undermine any kind of credibility that you have. And your standing among your colleagues is so essential. That's why censure has been so devastating to so many members of the Senate over the years, because it undermines an individual's standing with his or her colleagues. And in the Senate, it's the personality, the reputation, the collegiality of it. It's just, it is a club still in many ways. It's a changing club. It's an always changing club because the voters are sending new members. And the dynamics of the institution change with each election. But the personalities are essential to the institution.
And how have events guided?
Well, the Senate in the earliest period was equally divided between northern and southern states. And so that the states with slavery and the states without slavery were exactly equal in the Senate. In the House, the northern industrial states had the larger majority because of the population. And so from that point on, any decision over slavery before the Civil War had to be decided in the Senate. That was the body that took the lead. And right on through, practically to the eve of the Civil War, the great debates and the great compromises were worked out in the Senate. Other events that have changed the Senate, the First World War, for instance. There was a major filibuster in 1917 against arming merchant ships. And at that point, the Senate had no rules to cut off a filibuster. Unlimited debate was something that distinguished the Senate from the House. President Woodrow Wilson was so outraged that a little group of willful men would filibuster against an important measure on the eve of a major war, that he urged the Senate to establish its first cloture legislation. And that did happen in 1917.
And cloture means taking steps to end the filibuster,
yes,
right?
Yes, a procedure for cutting off a filibuster. At first, it was two-thirds of the senators were required. It was very hard to get. In fact, it was another 40 years before cloture was actually voted, I think, successfully. For many years, Southern senators used filibusters to block civil rights legislation. And civil rights definitely influenced the shape of the Senate. Finally, in 1964, cloture was successfully voted to cut off the longest debate in the Senate's history, over 80 days worth of filibustering and debate on the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And since then, cloture has been reduced. Now it's only three-fifths of the senators. But they don't want to lower it to just a simple majority vote because there are certain points when they feel it's important that the minority voice should be heard and that minority position should be argued as much as possible. The Senate is sort of a break on the popular whims and passions of the era. And that's exactly what Madison and the other framers of the Constitution had in mind.
Well, maybe then my next question is already answered. Do you think in the long run, and that's what you look at, that it has been intelligent to let the inmates define the institution as they move across time?
Yes, the Senate sets its own rules. The Constitution provides for that. And interestingly enough, there's a debate, it's gone now right to the Supreme Court this year, over the way the Senate handles impeachment proceedings. That the Senate was involved in three impeachment trials in the last few years. And to try to handle these impeachment trials, they decided instead of doing it as a body, that they would set aside a committee to hear the impeachment evidence and then present that evidence to the Senate as a whole. One of the judges who was impeached, Judge Nixon in Alabama, objected that that this was not, according to the original constitutional idea of the Senate as a whole sitting as a court. And that lower federal court agreed with him, and now that is being appealed to the Supreme Court. My suspicion is the Supreme Court will say that the Constitution gives the Senate the right to decide its own rules, and that would include the rules of impeachment. That the Senate and the House have very different rules. Each one has shaped rules that fit itself as a body, and they've adjusted those rules as time has gone on. Now, the senators, of course, are the ones who actually vote on it, but of course, every citizen votes on their senator now, at least since 1913, we have direct election of senators. And so it is something that eventually gets down to the popular level. The average voter may not know all of the esoteric turns of the Senate rules, and most of the senators probably don't even know all of those turns. But then again, when a big issue comes up, or an issue that touches a nerve, like the salary issue did recently, people do get their attention is caught on it, and they become involved, and they let their representatives know what's happening. And so as a result, the Constitution was amended this last year, for the 27th Amendment, with an amendment that was originally written by James Madison in 1789 and has been floating around out there ever since to restrict any salary increase until after the next election. And that is interesting, is that all the other branches of the government, their salaries were defined in the Constitution. The Congress cannot lower a president's salary during the president's term or raise it during the president's term, and they cannot lower a judge's salary. So they can't use salary as a weapon against the other branches. But there was no definition of how they could handle their own salary. And now at least the Constitution says, yes, you can raise your own salary, but you have to wait until after the voters have had a chance to assess what you've done.
In this case, the Senate is showing itself to be an institution of continuity, then. It remembers its own history. It reaches back into history to find something that will work today.
Very much so. The Senate has a very keen sense of history. They call it precedent rather than history sometimes. But they like to do things according to precedent. We've just published a new volume of the Senate Procedure, which is really all of the collected precedents of the Senate over the last 200 years. And of course, the Senate can overrule any one of those precedents, and they, by a simple majority vote, can change the precedent, and they do. But they do want to know how they've handled things in the past. As the Senate is a continuous body because only one-third of its members stands for election with each election, whereas every single member of the House runs in every election, so that there is a sense of continuity in time. And that was one reason why they created a historical office. The Senate was in the vanguard of creating an historical office. The House, only a few years later, created an historical office. And the Senate, because they understood and appreciated their special position in history, they wanted to make sure that their records were being properly treated. The Congress was appropriating money for presidential libraries for years, and yet was really not paying much attention to its own documentation. And our office was created in 1975 when Senator Hugh Scott, the Republican leader, and Mike Mansfield, the Democratic leader, got together and felt that it was important to have a regular, permanent historical office to take care of the records of the Senate, to assist researchers, and to be a reliable source of information about the Senate.
You not only collect, but you open the doors.
That's right. We are there to promote the history of the Senate. We're not there to write it ourselves. We're there to make it easier for researchers, for scholars, for journalists, for the senators and the senators' staff to find the information and to use it in their own work.
This is Donald Ritchie with now the Senate Historical Office nearly since the beginning. He came in just a year after it was established. He has taught throughout the years, most recently as an adjunct assistant professor at the Cornell in Washington program. He did that for between the years 90 and 91. Among his books, there are some forthcoming, Doing Oral History by Twain Press, a press for which you are an editor, mm-hmm. yes? And also Young Oxford Companion to the United States Congress, an Oxford University press publication, both forthcoming. Books in print, The Press Gallery, the story of Congress and the Washington correspondence, and also The History of a Free Nation. He is a co-author, and that one is a textbook. If you want to know more about the Senate, there is a book called The Senate, which came out in 1988, and that's a part of what series?
That's the Chelsea House Know Your Government series. It's designed for students, and there's a volume on the Senate and also one on the House of Representatives.
When I was thinking about the Senate in preparation for this interview, I started thinking about the times that have tried the soul of the nation. And in our time, in this generation, seems to have been the civil rights movement, Vietnam, and then Watergate. Mm-hmm. Are these times that have also tried deeply the soul of the Senate?
Oh, yes, yes. The Vietnam War, for instance, really rent the Senate in two. Colleagues who had been on the same side on domestic legislation suddenly found themselves confronting each other over foreign policy issues. It was a very difficult time for the senators and for the staff members, I think, as well, as many of them came to grapple with their own conscience. I think of senators like Stuart Symington of Missouri, who had been at one time a secretary of the Air Force, was a hawk's hawk, and yet in going home and talking to his own sons, realized how the generational differences had developed over the Vietnam War and made him rethink his hardline position. And Symington made a major political journey, in a sense, from being a hawk to at least tolerating the doves, if not being a dove, and in fact voting in some ways with the doves on the Vietnam War. Senator J. William Fulbright, in the 1950s, Lyndon Johnson called him my Secretary of State, because when Johnson was Majority Leader, Fulbright was the Senate Chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. They had a major falling out in 1966 over the Vietnam War. And for many years, Fulbright was never invited back to the White House, even though he held an important position. And certainly, so many other senators were caught up in that decision. Senator Philip Hart of Michigan even grew a beard. You know, he was the only senator in recent years to have a beard, but part of it was to show his identity with the younger anti-war generation that was fighting, in some cases, right out on the Capitol steps. When I first came to Washington in 1967, there were many demonstrations around the Capitol regarding the Vietnam War. So that institution was deeply shaken by that. And I think it's still today many of the younger members of the Senate are people who were of the Vietnam generation. They either served or they at least confronted morally the whole issue of the war. And they're very conscious when, for instance, just recently they debated the Persian Gulf incursion. Many of them talked back to their experiences and their thoughts that were shaped during the Vietnam era. And that was one of the most moving moments in the Senate's history since I've been working for the Senate, certainly as each member of the Senate stood up to explain how they were going to vote dealing with the Persian Gulf.
Was this trial a surprise for the Senate? That is to say, do bodies like the Senate assume business as usual, that their hearts will not be challenged, their souls will not be tried, but their intellects put to use at work?
Which trial?
The trial of the Vietnam era.
Oh.
Do they come as a surprise to bodies like this?
Yes, I think so. I think that politicians tend to be very pragmatic people, and they think that there's a solution, that there's a compromise. Look at Webster, Clay, and Calhoun, who spent all their years trying to find the compromise that would avert the Civil War, and of course, nothing averted the Civil War. The issue was too fundamental. There was a moral issue that had to be dealt with. Some things that cannot be compromised. And that's very difficult for people who are elected to get something done, to be positive. And they're somewhat shocked sometimes, I think, by events. And that you do see some political transformations as a result of that.
I want to turn to the way we perceive our elected officials. The Senate, the word Senate means the elder gentlemen, the elder aristocrats, who govern for life. Some of our senators are beginning to look like they're going to govern for life, and the nation has lately, in this most recent election, and I think probably in elections to come, we are clamoring for what we call amateur representation.
Mm-hmm.
What is your thought about the lifetime commitment some people make to the Senate and a nation that is clamoring to make that stop.
Well, it's interesting, the whole debate over term limits. Some of the members say that every voter has a chance to limit the terms of their own representatives and their own senators just by voting against them. The funny part is that most people tend to be satisfied with the work of their senator or their representative, because that senator and representative spent a long time working for that district or that state and certainly studied the popular mood in those areas and tried every way possible to show that they are promoting the interests of that their state and district. It's not their own member that they object to. It's usually everybody else's member that they object to. They're very happy to re-elect their own member, but they'd like to see term limits across the board. And, the Senate and the House have a mix of members. I've been in the Senate since 1976 as a staff member, and I've seen many senators come and go, some of whom have served one term, some have served even shorter than one term, some of whom have been re-elected. There's only about a third of the U.S. Senate that was there when I first came in 1976, so the great number of them have come and gone in those years. Now, some of those people are going to spend their careers, and others are going to go on to other things, or the voters are not going to send them back. Some of them do their work very well, and some of them don't pan out as well as people thought. And the voters seem to have a pretty good sense of who they should send back and who they shouldn't. There are amateurs in politics already. In fact, there was a book just recently called Astronauts, Athletes, and Actors, and it was talking about the type of non-professional politician who's being elected to public office these days. In the 19th century, U.S. senators were elected by state legislatures. They tended to have long experience on the state level, and they often were served as governor of their states, and they received their U.S. Senate seat as a reward for their long years of party loyalty. When they came to the Senate, they tended to vote with their party. Nowadays, people run for the U.S. Senate who have never held a political office before. They never served in the state legislature. They were never governor of their state. They were an actor or an athlete or an astronaut. And they got the name recognition, and they ran for office. And when they get to office, they can vote pretty well any way they want. They're not bound to follow their party. So to some degree, we have amateurs. We have very, I'd call them professional amateurs who are in office to some. They're not professional politicians. They are much more independent-minded people. Very rarely is a vote in the U.S. Senate a strict party-line vote. Almost every vote has some Republicans and some Democrats together. And the institution doesn't like to get itself polarized so that the Republicans and Democrats or the liberals and conservatives don't get together, because while we may vote together on a domestic issue, or we might be opposed to each other on a domestic issue, we might find some common ground on a foreign policy issue. So it's always good to keep your avenues open with all the members and to try to cultivate friendships. When Dan Quayle was a U.S. Senator, he passed a major piece of legislation which was co-sponsored by Ted Kennedy, and that was a jobs bill. And the Kennedy and Quayle certainly are as far apart politically as any two politicians could be, but they found it in their interest to come together on that particular legislation. And that's not an unusual case study. There are many other cases like that.
Do you think when we get, we, the electorate, the great rabble, gets clamorous about an issue that we tend to misperceive reality? I have just said people are upset about professional politicians, and you have just responded by saying, well, if you look at it, they may behave professionally, mm-hmm. In keeping their office, but there are mm-hmm. also many amateurs in the business.
Well, as an historian, I find that there's usually many ways of seeing the same situation. And the closer you get to any issue or any institution, the more complicated it appears. The further away from it you get, the more black and white it can be. And it's easy sometimes, and of course the politicians themselves play those same black and white issues. Many members of Congress run for re-election by running against Congress. They are going to clean up Congress. They are going to be different from the rest. So they add to that as well, I think. There's certain stereotyping and cartoonizing of the way the legislative body works.
Is that a useful ploy, running against Congress? Or do people really, can you survive being in Congress and being an outsider?
Well, they've been doing it for about a century now that we can document it. It seems to work.
And, running on that.
Yes, I think it's much more prevalent in the House than in the Senate. Uh, that running against the institution often works, and not being seen as part of the institution is important. On the other hand, seniority is a very important issue, and especially from a smaller state, seniority is critical for giving you leverage with the larger states. And so the smaller states will quite often re-elect their members over and over, and their members will run on a ticket of saying, I have been there so long, I am chairman of a committee, I am ranking member of a committee, you elect my opponent and you'll have a freshman who won't have anywhere near the influence that I do. So that works. At the same time the concept of term limits work, the concept of seniority balances it off and makes the issue more complicated. I don't think there's a simple answer for any of those things, and in fact I can see very good reasons on both sides of the term limit issues, and that the larger industrial states tend to lose out by not re-electing their members as often, and smaller states do tend to re-elect their members more often. There has never been a New Yorker who chaired the Senate Appropriations Committee, probably the most powerful of all the Senate committees. The current chairman is from West Virginia, previously where they were from Arkansas and from Arizona. They tend to not to be Californians and Texans and Floridians and New Yorkers, but from states with much smaller populations with a more stake in re-electing those members so that they do get the seniority to chair the committees. Mississippi has been re-electing Jamie Whitten for 50 years, and he is the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee.
This is Conversations. We're talking today with Don Ritchie, U.S. Senate historian. His degrees were taken in order, a B.A. from the City College of New York in 1967, followed by his master's from the University of Maryland in 69. His Ph.D. followed also from the University of Maryland in 1975. All history?
Yes.
All history. Donald Ritchie, our guest today on Conversations. This nation thinks of itself as a nation without tradition. We are forward-looking. We have a short history. We don't pay much attention to it. In fact, we step on it frequently. And we're always, the ego, I think, the hubris is that we're always looking forward. Certainly compared to Asian nations, China, Japan, our history is a blink. Even compared to Europe, it's short. Do you think we have tradition that we don't see from a historian's perspective?
Oh, I think so.
You think there's something that is American about us?
I think we also have more of a history than we think we do. We celebrated this year the quincentennial of Columbus's voyage. And of course, when Columbus got here, he found that North and South America were already occupied. In fact, here in Alaska, this is the beginning of North American history that goes back 10 or 20,000 years as the first inhabitants began to come across the Bering Straits. And for many years, we defined American history as the history of the white colonists. American history textbooks, for instance, were written from a New England perspective. They began with the Pilgrims. Well, of course, even in the continent of the United States, and even if you're just dealing with the European confrontation with the native population, it didn't begin in New England, it began in the Southwest. And so we've had in the last few years to rewrite American history so that Columbus is not the beginning of chapter one. Columbus is now the beginning of chapter two. The first chapter in my high school history textbook is about the world in 1492, about the interconnections, about the Native Americans in North and South America, but also about Europe and about Africa and about Asia and the roots between them and the reasons why the Europeans suddenly stumbled onto North America when they did. And now when we study American history, we look at more than just since 1776. We go back to the colonial period, we go back to the Spanish and French colonial periods, as well as the British colonial period. Our history is much more complex. We're studying Native Americans in ways that we never did before, and certainly as an oral historian, I'm very aware of the way that the oral histories of Native peoples is being recorded, people who don't have a long written documentation, but who still have a very rich oral tradition. I think our history is much more complex than we give it credit, and it's getting better. And I think historians are getting more sensitive to issues. We are aware of more things than we were before, and I think through the public history movement, we're beginning to make the general public more aware of what their history is. I just came from the Alaska Historical Society meeting in Anchorage, and there were many people there from the National Park Service, for instance, who are bringing the histories of their particular parks to the people who visit those parks. There are people who are involved in documentary filmmaking. There were some slideshows, for instance, on early Anchorage history, or on the Alaska Highway, or on restoring some of the trails, the old historic trails that have been lost over time, but they're trying to find them and reroute them and remap them for current travelers and visitors. There's so many ways in which we're trying to get the history out of the university, out of the classroom, out of the library, and into the community so that the people know what their own history is.
And it sounds like so history can become a living history as well. Mm-hmm. It's not tucked away. One tends to hear that history is the history of generals and battles and revolutions, and oral history is the history of a people. As a public historian, kind of a third branch, do you see them in that way, or are they more a part of a weave?
Well, it's interesting that when oral history began, the first interviews tended to be with the generals and the senators and the famous. In recent years, especially since the 1970s, there was a movement towards doing history from the bottom up and interviewing the workers and the farmers and the average citizen.
The real people.
Yes. And for many years, when I first became active in oral history, that our meetings would be a battlefield between those who are doing history from the top down and those doing history from the bottom up. In recent years, I think we've come to realize that history is all of those things combined. That if you're interested in the life of the workers, that you have to study the managers as well, the people who are calling the shots in many cases, to understand the interaction between the two. I know the Marine Corps oral historian, a very good oral historian, but when he began and we first were talking about what he was doing, he explained to me, I only interview generals. And having served in the Marines, I thought that was too bad, but that there were a lot of other Marines who deserved to be interviewed as well. Now he does interview across the board of all ranks, and he's been to Beirut and Grenada to interview the troops immediately after battle. And not just interviewing the generals anymore. So yes, I think oral history and public history have been a big boost towards redefining what we think is American history and making it more accessible to people. Getting it back, there's a big sense of returning the history to the community. We go out and we interview people, and then should we just leave it here in the library, or should we bring it back in the form of a film or a museum exhibit, or something else that people can come back to and discover. And there are some wonderfully creative things that are coming along that I think will make history more interesting than most people remember from their high school days of history. And even the textbooks look different. When I was in high school, everything was sepia-toned, and I began to think that everybody who ever did anything history had a long gray beard. Well, nowadays, history textbooks are multicolored, and we realize that wars, for instance, were fought primarily by adolescents, and many young people did things, not just older people. And in fact, there were women in history. When I first started teaching in 1968, two of the women in my class came up and said, there were no women in their textbook. And I said, of course there are women in this textbook. And they said, no, there are no women in this textbook. So I said, all right, let's go look at the index of the book, and we'll count up all the women. And we did, and we found two women in that, and it was a very good textbook for its time. And the two women were Queen Isabella and Jane Addams. They were the only ones mentioned by name. Now, as you go through books, you realize that we have rediscovered the fact that women had a role in history, some of whom became famous and some of whom really were frontiers women who toiled and without getting any fame or fortune at the time, but who played a role in the history of the nation.
Do you think oral history has helped to effect this transformation because the voices of what we think of as the smaller people are set down?
Yes, I think so. It's even helped us to re-examine the written documents. because it's made us rethink things. With the oral history, of course, you can go out and you can interview people in the community, in your church, in your own family, or in association with some particular issue, for instance, like the builders of the Alaska Highway, many of whom are still alive and who still have memorabilia and things like that, that the oral historians collect their photographs and other materials. They even collected a motorcycle from one of the builders who rode the motorcycle up before the road was even there. So there are these artifacts that are important documents, really, in a sense. But now, because we're doing oral history, we're going back and looking at what's been in the archives all along. And I read a fascinating book about the American Revolution called The Revolution Recollected, in which the historian found all the pension applications of the soldiers from the American Revolution. There were no records at the time of who was mustered in and out of the army. But so when these people were very old, sometimes 40 years after the battle, they went to a notary public in their town, and they dictated their reminiscences of their service. And these documents were sent to Washington, where clerks would look them over to see, were these accurate? If you said the sun was shining and they knew it was raining on the day of the battle, you didn't get your pension. But if your recollections were accurate, then you could get a government pension. And a wonderful cross-section of interviews can be found in these documents at the archives, and they've been published by the University of Chicago Press, some of whom were black soldiers who were slaves who ran away to fight for freedom for the colonies with the hope that they would get their freedom as well once the war was over. Some were interviews with women who came along to do laundry for the troops. In my textbook, we used Sarah Osgood as one of the prototypes of a person who was involved doing, she was at Yorktown when Cornwallis surrendered, for instance. And there's a wonderful eyewitness account that's been sitting in the archives literally since the American Revolution, and no one bothered to look at it. No one really thought about what that document would tell us. Why is it important to hear the words of a black soldier in the Revolution, or a woman who accompanied the troops, or a foot soldier, as opposed to the memoirs of the generals, which we have plenty of in the libraries?
Tell me about the ethics of oral history. When you write the history of a general, this person is a public figure. He or she has allowed by his or her success to put themselves out there in front of the public. But what about a laundress in the Civil War? Or what about a private person living in Fairbanks, Alaska, who has the accident of history thrust upon them?
Oral historians are very concerned about those issues. We realize we have a responsibility for the people that we're dealing with. We have to protect them from exploitation and from unnecessary intrusion into their lives and their privacy. We feel that their story is important, and we do want to record it, and we want to make it available. But we let them know that they have rights right from the very beginning. We tell them, for instance, that they have copyright over their materials. Until they agree to give that copyright to, let's say, the University of Alaska or any other sponsoring organization, or to the interviewer or to the project, but they sign a deed of gift in which they will establish what those rights are. In some cases, it's, I'll do this interview now, but it cannot be released for 10 years or until my death or something to that effect. We're very conscious of those rights. And in fact, if you don't have a deed of gift for an oral history, it can jeopardize the program because you won't be able to publish the material, the copyright will be in question, you won't be able to put it in the library because the librarians won't be able to release it without that. So we have some booklets, a little booklet called Oral History and the Law that the Oral History Association puts out to inform people about this. And then we have just recently revised the principles and standards of the Oral History Association to take a lot of these issues into account. So that, for instance, when I do an oral history, the first 5 minutes of that interview is explaining to my interviewees what their rights are. And I tell them that this interview remains closed until they open it. And that they should feel that they can be candid, they can be open, they can say what they think is important to say, and that this tape and transcript will be their control until they sign that deed of gift. And many of my interviewees, and I interview mostly retired staff members of the Senate, they were in positions where they were professionally quiet all their lives. They worked for a senator, they wrote speeches for the senator, they made that senator look good so that senator could get reelected, and they never got in the newspapers themselves. In fact, if you're a staff member and your name got in the newspaper, that might jeopardize your job. Now, they're retired, but they still have the sense of loyalty to their It's the senator that they worked for, who may be long deceased, but they still are somewhat reticent. And I explain to them all those provisions, and they usually say at the very beginning, well, we're going to have to keep this closed for a long time. But then after I've gone back and interviewed them several times and hopefully gotten their trust, and they realize what the process is, and they've told their story, at the very end, they usually will rethink that. And most of them open their interviews right away. We have very few that are closed, and closed in part rather than in whole in most cases. But most, I'd say 95% of our interviews open up right away. But most of those people would have been surprised when they started the process that they would have decided to open it then. Partly it's because they realize that the events are long past, and that they are leaving an important record. Now, what we do with our interviews is put copies in the Library of Congress and the National Archives for researchers, and then we send copies to libraries that have related interests. So if I was to interview someone who worked for, let's say, Ernest Gruning, we would send a copy to the Rasmussen Library to go with the Gruning papers and that sort of thing to make them accessible for researchers. Because we, as historians in the Senate, use those documents all the time because those are the people who knew why things were done the way they are. Things that were never put on paper, and all of the strange twists and turns of the way the legislature works, they've captured. They can see what was done as a ploy, as a, what was the front, the ruse, in a sense, that covered whatever the actions were going on behind the scenes. They understand the staging of things, and they'll tell you this is how to really understand the situation. I'll give you one quick example, and that was the National Defense Education Act. Passed in 1957, right after Sputnik went up. The Senate had passed an education bill for years, and the House had not. And when they finally passed it, the Senate said, well, money has to go out to people in the form of grants. And the House said, no, it has to go out to the students in the form of loans. And they fought for a month over this, and the House won, and it became loans. And I interviewed the man who was on the Senate committee, and I asked him, why did the Senate lose on this battle? And he looked at me for a second, then he broke out in laughter, and he said, that was one of the best ploys we ever used. He said, you know, the Senate had passed that bill for years, the House hadn't. He said, we had to give the House something on that. So I worked a deal out with the chairman of the House committee that the House would come up with loans and the Senate would come up with grants, and we would give up on it. And after a month's time, we did, and he said, you know, the House passed the rest of the bill exactly the way the Senate had written it. And it went right on through. And then he stopped for a second, and he said, and you know, most of the students never paid the money back anyhow.
This is Donald Ritchie. We've been talking about oral history and history writ large in the last couple of minutes. So an acknowledgement of Don Ritchie's participation in historical associations is important here. His connections, he serves actively with the American Historical Association, the National Council on Public History Editorial Board. He is a member of the Oral History Association, its past president, past vice president, and has served on a number of its committees, and also regional oral history groups as well. Donald Ritchie is an award-winning author and historian. By his peers, the Richard W. Leopold Prize for the best book by a public historian was awarded to him by the Organization of American Historians this year in 1992. It was for the book Press Gallery, Congress and the Washington Correspondence. The Henry Adams Prize for the best book was given to him by the Society for History in the Federal Government, also in 1992, also for Press Gallery,
yes.
Right? Yeah. The James Madison Prize for the best article was given by the Society for History in the Federal Government, and that article was The Loyalty of the Senate on Washington Correspondence in the Progressive Era. Finally, he has earned the Forrest C. Pogue Award for significant contributions to the field of oral history by the Oral History in the Mid-Atlantic Region organization. That was given in 1984. We're talking with historian Don Ritchie. I want to talk to you about an early book of yours. It's called James M. Landis, Dean of the Regulators. James Landis founded the Securities and Exchange Commission. He created, was the driving force in a number of the federal regulatory commissions of the United States. In many ways, a great person in our relatively recent history. You said that he devoted his life to making capitalism, in his own words, live up to its pretensions. This is a wonderful line. I want to know what did James Landis mean by that?
Well, Landis was a New Dealer at heart. He worked for Franklin Roosevelt, he worked for Harry Truman, he worked for John Kennedy. But at heart, he was a New Dealer. He came in the midst of the Depression in the 1930s, in 1933, as a young law professor, and helped to establish the first securities regulation, the Securities Exchange Commission. He was the second chairman after Joseph Kennedy, even though he really was the author of the legislation. And he did not believe that he was overturning the capitalist system. He was not a socialist. He was not a radical. He was not taking away private property. He was trying to regulate it so it worked the way it was supposed to work. During the 1920s, it was a period of great prosperity, somewhat like the 1980s, especially in the stock markets. But after the stock market crash in 1929, when Congress went back to look at the way the public had invested their money during the 1920s, it was found that almost half of all the money that was invested in Wall Street in the 1920s went to stocks that were, in some cases, either fraudulent or much less than what they appeared to be. And that meant that the public was misinvesting their money because they were getting poor information about what those companies were and what the stocks and others were. He was, through the Securities Act, was forcing the companies to be honest with their investors, to tell them exactly what their situation was, not to cover things up, not to cover up their weaknesses until the company collapsed. And in a sense, making capitalism work the way it was supposed to or live up to its own pretensions. And he and Franklin Roosevelt and others felt that when the New Deal was over, that capitalism was not weaker, but it was stronger than it had been before him. That capitalism might have collapsed if we had continued under the Coolidge and the Hoover policies for very long. That the alternative might have been a radical state-owned system, the way many of the Western European countries even went, not alone what was going on in Eastern Europe and the communist bloc nations, but look at what happened to France and to England in the 1940s. We did not have that kind of nationalization of our industries, and in part they felt it was because of the policies and the programs that the New Deal enacted. And in recent years, for instance, when the stock market crashed in 1987, the banks didn't collapse necessarily the way that they did in the 1920s. There was a safety net of protective legislation, much of it passed in the early 1930s by people like Landis. And he was a fascinating man. That's the reason I got involved in oral history, by the way. I was doing very traditional political research. I was reading manuscripts at the Library of Congress, all of the letters of James Landis. And one day I found in his files the last 50 pages of a 700-page interview with the man. Now, he had died 10 years before I began my research. And of course, I wanted to read this entire 700-page interview. I didn't know anything about it. I realized that he had been reading it in stages and hadn't finished editing the last transcript before he died, and that was why it was still in his papers. And by a little hunting, I found that the whole interview was at the Columbia Oral History Project in New York. And so I went up to read this 700-page interview, and it was a first-person account by a man I was writing a biography of, in which he discussed his whole life. It was a magnificent document. It just changed my research completely. It changed my attitudes about so much of what he did. It made me understand what his motivations were. But I wasn't necessarily satisfied with this as a document because, among other things, in 700 pages worth of transcript, he never mentioned either of his two wives or either of his children or the divorce that caused him to leave his job as a professor at Harvard, or the fact that he failed to pay his taxes for many years at the end of his life and went to jail and was disbarred as a result of this. These were not things that he wanted to talk about in the interview. So I then went out and interviewed his widow and his children, his law partners, and even his psychiatrist as part of my research to find out what it was about his life that was not in his own interview and was not in his own manuscript collection, so I could try to piece together as complete a picture of the man as I could find.
Do you think in some ways you're a product of your times, that at another time the historian Don Ritchie would not have thought what lays behind Jim Landis?
That's probably very true, and in fact I think even my own graduate advisor was a little dubious about some of the work that I was doing. I think but good historians have always wanted to know everything. Especially if you're writing a biography, you want to know everything that that person did over every minute, and you're frustrated about what you won't know, about what goes on behind closed doors and what there isn't a record of. And you try very hard to talk to the people who might have known, to look for the documents. I even found the man's autopsy report to find out whether or not he'd committed suicide. The New York Times in the obituary suggested he'd drowned in a swimming pool, and they suggested he'd just come out of prison and it might have been suicide. Well, the autopsy showed that he had had a heart seizure while he was swimming and that he'd died naturally, not of his own hand. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to establish that, to find every small piece of information. I don't think that's completely different than what my predecessors as historians would have done. But we are, as a people today, are probably more aware of all the dimensions of a person's life. We're certainly more interested in psychiatric issues that earlier historians might not have been. We're interested more today probably in the family life of a public figure than previous historians might have been. So yes, there's a contemporary nature to that. History is always being rewritten. And it may be that 50 years from now, another historian will write the life of James Landis from a very different slant than I chose to write it.
Mm-hmm. Once again, this is Don Ritchie. We're talking about history on Conversations. His public life was a life that really is a life of greatness. He moved his country. He transformed the economic regulations of his land. His inner life sounds, as you write it, as it's described, confused, self-doubting, persecuted by his personality in some ways. So here's my question. Do you think, in some ways, a culture asks for perfection in its public figures and thus sentences those who have foibles to a life of hell? Or is it the reverse, that the public figures ask too much of themselves and run into walls? Or is all of this an accident? Is there no question here?
Well, no, it's a very good question about the public and the private spheres. I've been working more recently on journalists. And until really the 1970s, journalists, for the most part, did not write about the private lives of public figures, unless that private life conflicted somehow with the public life. When James Landis didn't pay his taxes, that part of his private life became a public issue and it was legitimate for papers to write about. The fact that James Landis had trouble with alcohol while he was a public official was not something that reporters would have written about, even if they had evidence that he was an alcoholic. And he did verge on alcoholism many times during his career. His divorce, which caused him to resign as the dean of the Harvard Law School, was not really part of the public picture of the man. And it's true of politicians, of office holders, that there's a classic case about a young woman who was a reporter for a New Jersey newspaper in the 1950s and was covering a Senate debate, and she wrote back that the senator from her state who was sponsoring the bill was drunk. And the editor of her paper said, "I don't want to know whether he was drunk. I want to know whether he passed the bill or not." And that was the matter. If it interfered with his public life, then it was news. But if it didn't, well, then the reporter might have been drinking with the senator before they went on. In fact, reporters were very heavy drinkers at that stage, and they knew about the private peccadilloes of politicians. They knew all about Warren G. Harding's mistress, for instance, because Harding told them, but they just didn't publish that in the newspapers at the time. Once Harding died, then that became fair game for reporters to write about. Well, when I was writing about Landis, I was trying to look at these two sides, and I was so struck by how different he was in his public and his private lives. And you know, his family told me the same things about how aloof and distant he could become. He was a man who only got gratification from his public successes. He could work literally 24 hours a day for a government agency. He could bring a cot into his office and sleep there at night because he felt it was important to do that. And he felt he got exhilaration from doing that kind of work. He loved to be called to the White House and talk to the president, be congratulated by the president for a good job. He hated to go home and write bills, and so he would allow bills to pile up on his desk. And here's a man who wrote the legislation that set up the Securities Exchange Commission, and he would sometimes pay not only the bill, but the second and third notice of it when he finally got around to it, and get a credit from the company because he had triple paid what he was supposed to. He got no gratification from doing private things. He literally one year forgot to pay his income taxes. Now, he'd done that earlier in the 30s when his income wasn't very much and there'd be $100 to $200 that he owed. But in the 1950s, his income was getting close to $100,000 a year, and you don't forget to write your income taxes under that circumstances. He had actually, his corporate taxes had been paid, but it was his personal taxes that he just didn't file one year. And the next year, when he went to file, he discovered that he hadn't paid his taxes. And the first question on the 1040 form at that point was, did you file last year? And in fact, because of his case, they took that question off because they realized that was forcing a person to testify against themselves. He became trapped into this thing. He never did file his taxes until he was working for John Kennedy in the White House, and the IRS did a regular audit on all the new administrative appointees, and they couldn't believe that the dean of the Harvard Law School hadn't been paying his income taxes. And neither could the judge believe that it was a failing. I mentioned that I interviewed the man's psychiatrist. He told me that he would tell me on tape what he would have told a court if they had had a psychiatric defense. Landis chose to plead guilty, in part not to embarrass the Kennedy White House, in which he was an employee of at the time, and instead threw himself at the mercy of the court, which turned out not to have any mercy at that stage. But the psychiatrist felt that a miscarriage of justice had taken place. And so, with the family's permission, he told me what he would have said. And that's when I began to learn about this question of gratification and the fact that a man who seemed to be a supreme egotist, in fact, had a very frail ego. And I traced it back to his early childhood. I was very fortunate to find the letters of his parents. They were missionaries in Japan, and they were at the Presbyterian Historical Society in Philadelphia. And it was very clear from reading these that his father had been a brilliant man who'd gone into the mission field and then felt that he had wasted his talents, that he could have been famous in his, you know, and successful in another career, and drove each of his children to succeed. And each of his children felt a tremendous burden to succeed where their, in a sense, where their father felt that he had failed. And James Landis was always looking to gratify these family's wishes, and that they followed him right through his entire life.
It's interesting, not only can we learn about public figures from this story, but about lives and pressures on human beings. The story of James Landis is chronicled in a book called James M. Landis, Dean of the Regulators. It was published by Harvard University Press in 1980. A reminder about other books by Donald Ritchie, Press Gallery, a book that we haven't been able to get to in this hour, but which is a fascinating book about Congress and the Washington correspondence, came out also from Harvard University Press in 1991.
It's just out in paperback now.
Just out in paperback. You can see it at your bookstore. I'm Susan McGinnis. This has been Conversations. We've been talking today with Don Ritchie, the associate historian from the from the Senate Historical Office. Join me again for Conversations next week. Thank you, Donald Ritchie.
Thank you.